live via satellite. It's Rockline, the show where you interview the biggest stars in rock and roll. Rockline is brought to you by Mental on Fox.
Hi, I'm Tony Scott, in for Bob Coburn in Los Angeles, and tonight we welcome Eddie Kramer, Billy Cox, and John McDermott. To speak with Eddie, Billy, or John, call the toll-free Rock Line, 1-800-344-ROCK. That's 1-800-344-7625. One number, toll-free from anywhere in the U.S. or Canada. And now, let's welcome our guests. What a legend, and what a book on his life and music, the legend that is Jimi Hendrix. I'm Tony Scott for Bob Coburn this evening in L.A., and before me sits sound engineer, photographer, co-author of Ultimate Hendrix, Eddie Kramer. Hey, Eddie.
Good evening, everybody.
Good evening to you. Eddie certainly has his first-hand accounts of Jimmy, produced from Are You Experienced to Cry of Love. We'll have stories. In Nashville, author, bassman extraordinaire, Billy Cox. Billy, good evening.
Good evening, everyone.
As any Hendrix fan is well aware of, his own personal stories with Jimmy, he actually served in the Army with Jimmy, part of Gypsy Sons and Rainbows, also known as the Electric Sky Church and Band of Gypsies. He played with Jimmy at Woodstock, and Billy also played with Jimmy on that final tour. And in Boston is author, producer John McDermott. John is a savvy, seasoned vet when it comes to writing books about Jimmy, including Hendrix, Setting the Record Straight. John also had a hand in co-producing every Hendrix CD, DVD release. We've had plenty of them. I feel like Larry King. Cairo, you're on the air with Ozzy. Well, where do we begin? It could be a five-part miniseries, and even that would hardly scratch the surface. I guess my first question is, why this book? We've had plenty of books. Does this coincide with any anniversary of note? What inspired the three of you to collaborate on Mr. Hendrix?
Well, we had done a book called Hendrix Sessions, and, that came out in 1995, and, you know, it was just an opportunity at that time for Eddie, Billy, and I to look at Jimmy's recorded legacy, right, in a meaningful way with as much research and insight as we could put together. But what's interesting is that in that time, from then to now, the Hendrix family won a litigation to win back the rights to Jimmy's music, and we had the opportunity to uncover a lot of tapes that had gone missing and bring a lot of the archive back into the Hendrix family's hands. And as a result, we were able to kind of learn more and more about some incredible sessions, many of which we've released on record since then. So it was just the right time, I think, to bring it to people. That's why we felt that it was a good opportunity to pull together both an understanding of the shows he did and then all that incredible amount of work that he did in the recording studio. He packed a lot of incredible work into 4 years.
That was John McDermott in Boston. Thank you, John. Eddie, your thoughts on the whole thing coming back to the Hendrix family there?
Yeah, that was for us when we finally got the rights. John and I and Janie sat in the studios here in L.A. trying to figure out where all the tapes were and cataloging it all and filling in all the gaps, because there were many, many, many gaps. And very fortunately, we over a very short period of time, we managed to put the whole library back together, and the decision was made then and there. If we're going to re-release some of this stuff, we got to do it right, because in so many cases, the record companies, in their infinite wisdom, have been using second, third, and fourth generation tapes, and we said, that's no good. So yeah, we found the original tapes, and the fans just responded in kind. You know, as soon as we put out great product, which we've continued to do, the fans just loved it.
Go figure. And Billy Cox, were you in on these meetings with Janie and everybody?
No, I wasn't in on the meetings, but nevertheless, this book was due to be put out. When you talk about the life and the legacy of Jimi Hendrix, and it's quite a bit. You might even be looking for another one to come out, but there's a lot of there are hundreds of hours of tapes of Hendrix in the studio, and there's a lot about his personal life still yet, some stories and various personal things about him that still needs to be talked about.
Well, it's an amazing book, Ultimate Hendrix. You got sessions, you got mixing and concerts and set list and some photographs I haven't seen before. Some great stuff in here. And the Ultimate Hendrix book is out, courtesy of these three amazing gentlemen. And we're going to hear plenty of Jimmy this evening. You know, yesterday was the birthday of the late Mitch Mitchell, who was actually on tour when he passed away. He would have been 62 yesterday. Quite the drummer.
He is sadly missed, and we all, every one of us who met him, knew him, played, worked with him, were in some ways affected by him. I mean, he, just God bless the man, you know, and his, we miss him terribly.
Everybody seems to have good words to say about Mitch Mitchell and his drumming on.
Well, I'm sorry, I was just going to say, we had organized that tour, the Experience Hendrix tour. Billy was a part of it, and, Mitch, every time we did a tour like that in recent years, Mitch really wanted to be a part of it. He just loved being out there and interacting with the musicians and being able to spend time with Billy, particularly, was so much fun for him, and he just had a wonderful time. I mean, he it was great to see him receive the adulation from fans because, Mitch lived in England for much of his life and, was over in the States for certain things, but it was just great to see fans connect with him, and I know that meant a lot to him. He held his work with, great pride and certainly his love for Jimmy, and he always wanted to, respect his legacy and help it grow. And, he was just a wonderful guy. Sadly, after that tour had ended, he passed away suddenly, and it was a great loss to all of us.
It was in Portland, Oregon, wasn't it? Where they found him?
Yeah, he had wanted to, when the tour finished, he wanted to stay behind and do some shopping and just rest, and he was going to visit some family he has in the United States, and on the day he was leaving, sadly, he passed in his sleep.
Mitch Mitchell would have been 62 yesterday. Listen, 1-800-344-ROCK, 1-800-344-7625 to talk to our gentlemen this evening. We have the great Eddie Kramer here, and we have Billy Cox in Nashville and John McDermott in Boston. I'm Tony Scott for Bob Coburn. Speaking of Mitch Mitchell, his drumming on fire, just sensational. And how about we play a track from Clark University, March of 1968, as we talk to the gentleman here about Ultimate Hendrix. The Jimi Hendrix Experience, doing fire at Clark University, March 15th of 1968, and the great drummer, the Mitch Mitchell. Billy, you had some words about the great late Mitch.
Oh, yeah, I miss him dearly. But 2008 was a rough year for me. We lost Buddy Miles in February and lost Mitch Mitchell in November. It was a rough year for me. It really was. And they both were missed by me. I'm still trying to make peace with that.
I'm Tony Scott, and for BC this evening, this is Rockline and 1-800-344-ROCK. That's 1-800-344-7625 to talk to Eddie Kramer, Billy Cox, and John McDermott, authors of a great book called Ultimate Hendrix. We're going to talk about the sessions and more Jimmy stories coming up shortly. As we go to break here, this is Stone Free, the Experience live in Paris on Rockline. On Kazoo, Eddie.
And a few other things.
Kazoo, like what other things? We're on the air, though.
Yeah, I know we are. No. This was cool. I mean, that's a wonderful session. Oh. That brings back great memories. A lot of crazy stuff that we did. There's phasing. There is Jimmy doing stuff with headphones feeding back. Oh, it's just, it's a wonderful, wonderful high-energy track.
One of the greatest short, sweet cranking numbers in the history of rock and roll. Crosstown Traffic off Electric Ladyland. I'm Tony Scott in for Bob Corbin this evening. It's Rockline. We have Eddie Kramer, who sound engineered so many greats from Jimmy. Billy Cox in Nashville, John McDermott in Boston. And in Smyrna, Tennessee, on Rockline, it's Mark to talk to the guys. I think specifically Billy. Is that right, Mark?
That's correct. Hello, John, Eddie, and Billy.
Hey, Mark.
Hello.
Hello.
Billy, I work over at Vought Aircraft in Nashville with your sister-in-law, Alice. She is such a sweet person.
All right. Yes, she is.
My question is about Band of Gypsies for Billy. The first time I heard that album was with two friends, and when the first few notes of Who Knows came on, our conversation just screeched to a halt, and we listened to the whole song without saying a word. And after Who Knows ended, we just looked at each other in amazement. I've often wondered what it was like to be you at those Band of Gypsies shows, playing bass and watching Jimmy redefine yet again what it means to play electric guitar. So that's my question. What was it like from your viewpoint at those Fillmore East shows, and did you realize at the time just how monumental that album would be?
No, we really didn't realize how monumental it really did become. If he had paid me a dollar a night, I probably still would have stayed there and played, because it was incredible just to sit and watch this guy play a guitar. He was phenomenal.
Have we got that call lined up from a guy in Maine who says he caught Jimmy way back? Cue that thing here. This is crazy.
One of my first concerts that I ever attended that I highly regard was Jimi Hendrix coming out in Lewiston, Maine in a jockstrap, a paisley velour velvet jockstrap with his cape. You remember how he used to come out with his cape and stuff?
Yes.
And not wear a shirt and maybe some tights? Well, he just came out in a paisley jockstrap and a velvet cape, and he just and then he ended up putting the guitar on fire, the whole nine yards. I mean, you talk about a memory. I mean, I got a lot of them like you do.
I'll tell you what.
I hit concerts everywhere.
Setting a guitar on fire wearing a jockstrap. I don't know that I've ever seen a show.
I know, that's pretty crazy, isn't it?
Guys, is he crazy?
I think Mr. McDermott said earlier something about adult beverages being served.
Yeah. It's a bad ice cube in there somewhere, I think.
Like I said, that wasn't Jimi Hendrix, it was Jimi Hendrix.
Oh, goodness. All right, it is Rockline. Tony for BC. We have Eddie Kramer here in L.A., Billy Cox in Nashville, and John McDermott out there in Boston, authors of a great book, Ultimate Hendrix, an illustrated encyclopedia of live concerts and sessions. Speaking of live work, let's go to Paris, the Olympia Theater, October 9th, 1967. This is Purple Haze, Jimi Hendrix Experience on Rockline. Merci beaucoup. Jimi Hendrix Experience live at the Olympia Theater, Paris, October 9th, 1967, doing Purple Haze here on Rockline. I'm Tony Scott with Eddie Kramer, Billy Cox, and John McDermott. John, thoughts on that show?
It was great. It was recorded for French radio. Fortunately, they recorded one of the very first Jimi Hendrix Experience shows in October of 66. When Jimmy and the band were just an opening act for the French pop star Johnny Hallyday. A year later, for that show that you just played, their success was such that they sold out this 15,000-seat venue as a headliner. So in the space of 1 year, three, four amazing singles and Are You Experienced, they had just blossomed to, be the most popular touring group at that time.
And also, when you hear the intro of that, you realize that Jimmy's guitar playing is from another planet. I mean, there is nobody in this world who's been able to even come close to what he does with the guitar. The sonic assault is something to behold. It is absolutely, it's incomprehensible how any human being can make those sounds. I mean, they're just beautiful. And he was such in control of the feedback and control of the guitar. The guitar was like a toy to him, and he was a complete master. You could hear that. And then at the very end of the song, after all this fantastic playing, he's using his teeth to get those, the last eight bars of it. It's incredible.
Folks, that's Eddie Kramer, sound engineer with so much of Hendrix's work, and John McDermott prior to him in Boston. And Billy Cox is in Nashville. They've co-authored a book called Ultimate Hendrix, and we're featuring clips from that, sessions and whatnot, music this evening on Rockline. Tony Scott for BC. As we go to break, in the treatment of mental illness, there's Crazy, and then there's Dr. Jack Gallagher. It's the new hit drama Mental, Tuesday at 9, 8 Central, only on Fox. Here's live Clark University work from the Jimi Hendrix Experience. It's Wild Thing. And this is Rockline. Tony Scott for Bob Coburn. This is Rockline, and we're with three interesting gentlemen, Eddie Kramer, Billy Cox, and John McDermott. Have a book called Ultimate Hendrix. Now, listen, next week we have Chickenfoot on Rockline. Native Window also coming up. Yes, we'll be here, and George Thorogood. And for more, just go to rocklineradio.com. That's rocklineradio.com for upcoming shows and information. We have an encore question for you, Eddie Kramer. Robin Trower was here last week, or recently. And he's got a question queued up for you. Listen carefully.
Hi, Eddie. This is Robin Trower. Long time no see. Hope to see you soon sometime. But in the meantime, here's a question for you. Can you tell me and the listeners how you managed to get such a fantastic sound on Hendrix's guitar on Voodoo Child, Slight Return?
Interesting.
Oh.
Okay. Is that an hour?
Well, at least. You want me to give you the answer now?
Yes.
Okay. This is the Record Plant Studios in New York City in 1968. And Jimmy, contrary to popular belief, is preparing to do a jam. But he goes about it in a very specific, organized manner. First of all, he would go to the Scene Club, which was two blocks away on 46th Street, jam there till about midnight, carefully picking the musicians he wanted, and then drag them down 8th Avenue, if you can imagine that, an entourage of 20 people walking down 8th Avenue, Jimmy leading the pack, holding a guitar with the hat with the feather and the whole deal, and stopping traffic, and then coming into the Record Plant. We're sitting there since 7 o'clock at night waiting for him. He comes in. We have everything prepared. He plugs in. They rehearse it once. We roll tape, and it is done. Live off the floor, live vocal, everything. You know, you've got Steve Winwood on organ, you've got Jack Cassidy on bass, Mitch Mitchell on drums. I mean, it is, but it's planned. It's a planned jam. In Jimmy's mind, he has very carefully crafted that moment so that when it hits, it's exactly what he wanted.
Not quite as spontaneous.
Very spontaneous.
Well, spontaneous in that he would go out and grab people, but the whole thing was planned right back
in his mind.
Studio.
He knew exactly what he was looking for, so when the moment was correct, he corralled all the musicians and got them in and made them play that song like you wouldn't believe.
Now, Voodoo Child was released a week after his death in the UK, if I'm not mistaken, and it was his only number one in the UK. And wasn't that the last song he played live at a show in Germany?
Boy, you'll have to ask John McDermott, who's the resident historian.
It was. He did do that at the Isle of Famarn. But I think, as Billy certainly can attest, I mean, Voodoo Child, Slight Return was definitely the show closer for much of his career. I mean, it was obviously a great number to for those guys to play.
Yeah, I always heard it was September 6, 1970 in Germany that he last played that, and it was the last thing he played live before he died 12 days later. That was the rumor I've heard for many years. Guys, we have Joe in Grand Rapids, Michigan, who's got a question for all three of you. Eddie Kramer, Billy Cox, John McDermott on Rockline. Joe, what's up?
Hey, Eddie Kramer. I just wanted to thank you for doing some of the Kiss albums and the Ace Frehley album. The Ace Frehley album is awesome.
We were just thank talking you. About that.
He's a great, much underrated guitar player, by the way. He's terrific. What's your question?
How did you guys choose the pictures that were going to be that are in the book right now?
That's a good question.
That's a great question, John.
Well, what we tried to do is cover every period. And certainly try to bring some fresh images that hadn't been seen. In particular, it was great to have access of some shots when Jimmy was a session musician and a sideman with the Isley Brothers, and to see him almost out of context, you know, when you compare the imagery and the look of everything from 1967 forward, it was great to see him there. But also, whenever we could, shots of him working in the studio, I think... you know, certainly as Eddie and Billy can attest from firsthand, you know, Jimmy was rare for his time in that he, you know, directed his sessions, and as Eddie had just mentioned in the Voodoo Child session, you know, had a real clear understanding and purpose when he went into the studio, and, you know, it wasn't a situation where you had an A&R person from a record company or, you know, different people trying to shape his vision, you know, apart from Chaz Chandler in the early going. You know, Jimmy assumed that role from Electric Ladyland on, and I think it's clear by the work that he created that, you know, he really had an understanding of his sound, but also the arrangements and what he wanted all of the various musicians to do.
Thank you. John McDermott in Boston. We've got Billy Cox in Nashville. Eddie Kramer right here with me in Los Angeles. I'm Tony Scott for Bob Corbin. This evening on Rockline, a very special presentation of... Everything Jimi Hendrix, as we talk about this great book, Ultimate Hendrix, and we will get to that. Okay, let's set up this next song. All Along the Watchtower, the story goes, Jimmy and Dave Mason are in New York at a party, and they hear Dylan's version played at the party. Eddie, you're wincing.
No, I'm not wincing. I want to see where the story's going to go first.
Rumors have it, Hendrix hears the Dylan version of this. Of John Wesley Harding, and he and Dave rush back, and they get to work on All Along the Watchtower.
That's, I'm afraid, is not true, only in the sense that this track was recorded in London.
Okay.
In 1968, the end of, beg your pardon, the end of 1967, before I came to America. The basic tracks were recorded there, not in New York. Yes, Dave Mason did play on it,
right.
And there was no bass while it was being tracked. And I remember Jimmy yelling at Dave Mason because he couldn't get the chords straight.
Okay, yeah, because I heard Dave dubbed his bass in later.
No, it was Jimmy. Jimmy played bass.
All right, okay.
So that's the true story.
There we go. So that's why you're here.
I do try. I think my memory banks are still okay.
Let's roll it All Along the Watchtower from Electric Ladyland on Rockline. Reliving the moment that they laid that classic down off Electric Ladyland. It's Rockline, Jimi Hendrix Experience, All Along the Watchtower. You had a comment to make about that.
Yeah, very quick extra little story, a little snippet of information. On that session, round about take 21 or 22, there were 27 or 28 takes, actually, but round about take 21, 22, we hear this horrible sound of this out of time, out of tune, out of whack piano being played. Clang, 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 clang. It's just horrendous. And it's poor Brian Jones, who was a dear friend of Jimmy's. And, you know, the Stones, I was recording Stones and Hendrix, blah, 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 back to back, you know, sometimes. And he stumbled into the studio. Unfortunately, he was in a rather delicate state. And Jimmy never could say no to his buddies. And he came in and tried to play piano on this. And it was so bad. And then Jimmy was winking at me and going, oh, can you get him out of here, get him out of here. So we managed to get him out of the studio, bring him back in the control room. And he fell in a big heap and fell asleep. And then we went on, carried on and recorded the tracks up to about take 27, which is where the master was.
So how many takes did Jimmy average?
It depended. Like, we gave the example of Voodoo Child, one or two takes. This was 27, 28, maybe even 29 takes, because Jimmy and Mitch and Dave were basically putting the arrangement and learning it on the spot. So the studio would be treated as a rehearsal as well. So you couldn't really say.
Gotcha. Eddie Kramer.
That changed, too. Billy should jump in, but I think because Jimmy and Billy were so tight, you know, they rehearsed a lot of what they called patterns together, you know, whether it was in a hotel room or Jimmy's apartment. But I think as the band shifted and Billy joined the band, I think it was different, because instead of kind of learning it in the studio, particularly Eddie and certainly Billy can talk about it, you know, by the time you're getting to the Electric Lady studio sessions, you know, a lot of those songs, you know, Jimmy and Billy had just really worked out so that they were locked in.
That's John McDermott in Boston. Billy's in Nashville. Billy.
Yeah.
Hi.
Yeah.
How are you?
We were locked in, for sure. But a lot of times, he was a perfectionist. It had to be perfect. No flaws at all, and Eddie can attest to this. And, of course, I never got tired. I just hung in there for the duration until we got it right. And sometimes we'd go in with a song one evening, and we'd do that whole song all that evening, 10, 15, 20, 30 takes, come back the next day, finish it up. But he was definitely a perfectionist.
Billy Cox in Nashville, Eddie Kramer in Los Angeles with me, Tony Scott. I'm in for Bob Coburn. This is Rockline, 1-800-344-ROCK. That's 1-800-344-7625 to talk to Eddie, Billy, or John. Ryan's on the phone from Lamar, Arkansas. He's got a question for all three of you guys. What's up, Ryan?
Not much. Good evening, gentlemen.
Oh, be careful how you use the word gentleman around us.
speaking of which, the difference between Bob Dylan and Jimi Hendrix's version of All Along the Watchtower is that Jimi Hendrix could actually sing.
Oof.
Well, it's interesting you should say that, because apparently Dylan, after he had heard Jimi's version, actually used Jimi's arrangement of it, if I'm not mistaken. Is that correct, John?
Yeah, he's... You know, Dylan certainly has always, you know, it's kind of paid homage back to Jimmy by doing it in that manner.
Ryan, thank you for calling up Rockline this evening.
No problem. It's an honor to be able to talk to you guys. Of course, got questions for all three of you. Eddie, what was the situation like for you at Woodstock for recording? Billy, what was Woodstock like for you as a performer? And John, how hard was it for you to find the unreleased Woodstock material?
Oof. All right, I'll go quickly. Woodstock was 3 days of drugs and hell, a battlefield of sonic impossibility. That's all I can tell you, but we managed to get it done. Johnny.
Well, you know, finding the most interesting thing that we found was just a classic Woodstock story, was that there was a young student who had volunteered to work in one of the medical tents, who had, for the time, it was rare for somebody to have it, an open reel video recorder, black and white camera and video recorder. And he said, you know, I could probably bring this back and videotape Jimi Hendrix. So the next day he comes back, walks right up on stage with this huge hulking thing that, you know, probably weighed about 40 pounds, a tripod, sets it up on stage. Nobody stops him, thinking he's part of the Michael Wadley crew that was there filming the movie for Woodstock, and records the entire show.
Wow.
By chance, you know, they reached out to us, you know, probably a few years before we released the Woodstock DVD, and said, oh, you know, by the way, I videotaped Jimi Hendrix, and it was exciting to hear it. And he told an interesting story of how after a few days after the festival, he was hitchhiking, and somebody who had been working at a house Jimmy was renting up in Woodstock, you know, they happened to be small talking while he was giving that person a ride, and he said, oh, yeah, you know, I work for Jimi Hendrix. He says, oh, I filmed him the other day. And she said, oh, you should come show it for Jimmy. And believe it or not, the guy brought his deck down and showed the videotape to Jimmy. At that point, back in the day, there was no home video or VHS or DVD. And, you know, apparently Jimmy looked at it and said, oh, that's cool. And that was it. It went back into this guy's safe for 30 more years. And, you know, when we saw it, it was just an amazing kind of real-time capture of the show and what went on there. So it's a great counterpoint to the, you know, the wonderful film color film work that Michael Wadley and his team did.
That's John McDermott in Boston. Hey, speaking of Woodstock, Jimmy, have we got that clip queued up? Check this out. Here's Jimi Hendrix right before he went on at Woodstock.
Anything I want to say? Mm. Yeah, I can hardly wait till the gig comes because I'm more comfortable with a guitar in front of people. Matter of fact, what we're trying to stress also is like music should be done outside in a festival type of way, just like they do it anywhere else. You know, you play outside, say for instance, 3 days. At the fourth day, you play half the day outside, for instance, and maybe the other time in the Apollo, you know, four shows or whatever, you know.
Billy Cox, were you standing right next to him when that was said?
I presume I was.
But you know,
nevertheless.
That was right before you guys went on.
No, that was actually after.
Oh, was it after?
Okay. You haven't read Ultimate Hendrix there. Hold on now.
I thought that went right on.
No, actually, that was about a week or so later. He did a free benefit concert up in Harlem for a youth organization, and he was talking about the, you know, the philosophy of playing outdoors and, you know, doing large shows.
Yeah, I've heard you corrected BC a few times the last time you were here. This is perfect. Set me straight. I'm going to, you know, relabel a lot of my clips I have. It's Tony Scott for Bob Coburn, Rockline, and shall we go back to another call or should we play Foxy Lady, guys? Foxy Lady? Oh, did you want to answer something, sir?
Yeah, that guy wanted to know about Woodstock as a performer.
Oh, okay.
Right. Okay, so we entered the festival from the rear. We went up on a loft and opened up the curtains, and Jimmy said, oh, my God, we never saw that many people before. Mitch says, oh. So Mitch had a bottle of Blue Nun wine. So you can imagine what happened at that point in time.
They drank.
And by the time we got up there, Jimmy says, look, and as spiritual as he was, a very spiritual individual, he says, look, they're throwing a lot of energy our way. We'll throw it right back at them. And that's how we did that gig.
And did you ever...
Wow.
Or was that something? Thank you so much for that, Billy. Let's go to Foxy Lady. This was a great show, too. The Olympia Theater, Paris, January of 1968. This is Rockline. Gentlemen, we have been to Paris with the Jimi Hendrix Experience, January of 1968, the Olympia Theater. You're right, Eddie Kramer here, who remixed that after the fact. There was an interesting groove on that, kind of a
nice tempo.
Down.
It's very unusual to hear Foxy being played at that tempo. It's just a solid groove. It's very, because normally it's almost double that speed.
Right.
Billy, you remember that? How you know, you guys used to play Foxy, how fast it was?
Very fast.
Yeah, but this was cool, didn't you think?
That was real cool. I like that.
That's Billy Cox in Nashville. Eddie Kramer's with me in Los Angeles. John McDermott in Boston. Tony Scott for BC. This is Rockline. Here's your number to keep handy, 1-800-344-ROCK. 1-800-344-7625 to talk to the co-authors of Ultimate Hendrix. Folks, in the treatment of mental illness, there's Crazy, and then there's Dr. Jack Gallagher. It's the new hit drama, Mental, Tuesday, 9, 8 Central, only on Fox. Back to Paris as we go to break. This is Dear Mr. Fantasy on Rockline. Tony Scott for BC with Eddie Kramer in Los Angeles, Billy Cox in Nashville, and John McDermott in Boston. All right, manic depression. John, the story, please, because I heard parts of that were written at a press conference when Chaz gave Jimmy a hard time and told him to cheer up. You said no off the air.
No, that's true. I think Chaz, you know, Chaz was a great advocate for Jimmy, and you know what he did is he brought Jimmy to from Greenwich Village to London, and Chaz had been the bass player in the Animals, wanted to have a career as a producer, believed very firmly in the prospects of Hey Joe, and that was the first thing they did. It was a success, and that allowed them to keep recording, and you know, he certainly formed the experience around Jimmy, and they got off to a great start. I think that what was interesting about that those early times is that when Chaz and Jimmy lived together, they spent a lot of time working on Jimmy's music one-on-one. So there certainly was a lot of give and take about arrangements and how a lot of the songs that were on our, that ultimately became our experience, were crafted. But I think, you know, Billy, one of the interesting things about doing Ultimate Hendrix was learning from Billy about how some of the songs, like Foxy Lady, stretched as far back as, at least from their kind of root form, to the Chitlin circuit, where, you know, he had these ideas, he just lacked the opportunity. And that was the great thing that Chaz gave him, was the opportunity. Through Chaz, he got the chance to make records, to, you know, to be able to show his talent in a way that nobody had ever believed in him before. So that was really Chaz's great gift. He gave Jimmy the opportunity to just show off what he had. And I think with Manic Depression, you got to tip your hat certainly to Mitch Mitchell. It's one of the, you know, finest performances on record that he gave. And, you know, it really is just a wonderful record that has stood the test of time.
So back in the beginning, Chaz calls the shots. Jimmy listens. Chaz likes shorter, faster, you know, shorter tunes. And then Jimmy begins to feel his power and stretches music out. Is that accurate?
I would say so. Certainly, I remember Chaz being the guy in control to the extent that, hey, Jimmy, you know, first of all, we only have 3 hours. Second of all, I sold my bass to pay for this session, so you better hurry up. And it's true. A lot of the sessions were 3 hours. That was it. That's all we had. And, you know, because money was short. And the story about Chaz actually selling his bass to pay for one of the sessions is true. And certainly Chaz coming from this background of pop singles influenced Jimmy to try to keep the stuff shorter, and Jimmy had to force himself to play that amazing solo in 8 or 16 bars or 12 bars, whatever it was, whatever the solo was demanded of him. He would compact all of that beauty into this little diamond polished gem. It was just gorgeous to watch all of that come together. And then obviously later on, as Jimmy expanded, you know, his musical horizons through the second album, things started to stretch out more. And by the time we came to the States and we started on Electric Ladyland, and Chaz and Jimmy sort of parted ways, Jimmy just took over and just said, okay, now we're going to blow the doors open. This is going to be a double album, which it eventually became, long jams, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, give and take, yeah, in the beginning, but it was really, it was an interesting dynamic to watch the two of them.
Eddie Kramer. What was it, a love-hate relationship between Jimmy and Chaz?
Oh, I don't know about love-hate. I think they respected each other. Wouldn't you say, Johnny?
Oh, I think certainly, you know, and from Chaz's perspective, I think he had great admiration for Jimmy's talent. I mean, I think that was at the root of that relationship, was that, you know, he in Jimmy, he saw great potential. He was somebody who had 10, 12 top 40 hits as an artist in his own right as part of the Animals. Yet in Jimmy, he saw an even greater talent and said, you know, I can take what I've learned over these last 5, 6 years in toughing out a career as part of, again, one of the top acts of the British invasion, and give it to this guy who's an even greater talent. You know, the sky's the limit. And to his credit, I mean, Axis and Our Experience are just great records that are really well constructed. And I think he served almost as an editor in those days for Jimmy, and a soundboard to him to say, you know, this is good, maybe think about it this way. Or it may not have been, you know, really fixed, firm arguments, but just somebody who was an ally for him, which prior to coming to London, nobody had ever served that role.
John McDermott in Boston. Billy Cox is in Nashville. And Eddie Kramer with me, Tony Scott. I'm in for BC on Rockline. And the number to reach us is 1-800-344-ROCK. That's 1-800-344-7625. Bob in New Bedford, Massachusetts. You're on Rockline. What's up, Bob?
Hey, guys. How are you?
We're good.
All right.
Good, thank you.
Hey, my question is about the Jimi Hendrix Blues CD. I was wondering if Eddie had anything to do with putting that together, and if Billy plays on any of the tracks on that CD, and also if there's a chance that there'll be any new compilation CDs, perhaps of Jimmy playing cover tunes, or maybe a box set or something like that coming out in the future.
Johnny.
Johnny, you're on.
Johnny, boy.
I'm put
Johnny.
Forward.
Take it, run.
Well, to answer it quickly, that CD was done in '94, so neither Eddie or I weren't involved with it. Billy is certainly on some of the tracks. In terms of future releases, yes, there's definitely some wonderful music that will be coming out. We did do a box set in 2000 that was kind of a linear chronological look at Jimmy's career from the very first known shows recorded at the Paris Olympia in 66, right up to the last studio session he did with Billy and Mitch and Eddie in 1970. So, I mean, there's plenty more music to come. It's really wonderful stuff. It helps to kind of further define the Jimmy's legacy and kind of show where he was going prior to his death.
Guys, let's go to the Fillmore in San Francisco, February of 1968. Here's a song that Hendrix fans are certainly going to know on Rockline. Ladies and gentlemen, we've been to the Fillmore. Do we have to leave? That was a great one from 1968. This is Rockline. I'm Tony Scott and Bob Coburn. And three of my great guests this evening, we have Eddie Kramer in Los Angeles, Billy Cox in Nashville. We'll hear some Billy jamming on some Hendrix in just a bit. And John McDermott is in Boston. They co-authored Ultimate Hendrix. So, Farewell England, June 4th. 1967. Jimmy was about to leave, come over to the States to do Monterey. And I understand this was 3 days after Sgt. Pepper's had dropped from the Beatles. And half an hour before they go on, Jimmy runs back to the dressing room and tells Noel and Mitch that they're going to open with Sgt. Pepper's. John, what was the reaction to the crowd there when they actually opened with Sgt. Pepper's? Because McCartney and Harrison were there that night.
Well, McCartney says it was one of the high points of his career, which, considering his career, it's a pretty amazing statement to make for him to see Hendrix come out and do it in the way that he did. So I think it was just, you know, it's perfect Hendrix. He was so creatively free. He loved Dylan, loved the Beatles, was so open-minded, you know, wasn't self-conscious about music. If he felt it and wanted to play it, he would do it. And whether it was Like a Rolling Stone or Sgt. Pepper or any of those songs that he dug, he would just do it. Could be Bleeding Heart by Elmore James. As long as he dug it, you know, he would do it and do it to the best of his ability.
Eddie Kramer.
I've got a quick story that goes right along with what John was just saying. This story goes back to that same spot. It's actually the Savile Theater right. In 1967, which Brian Epstein owned. Mm-hmm. And literally, Sgt. Pepper had been out for 2 days. Jimmy had got hold of a copy. I went up to the dressing room. Actually, it was 5 minutes before they went on stage.
5 minutes?
Yes, sir. And I remember seeing Jimmy with a little record player in the corner and said, okay, guys, hear the chords. We showed them the chords. And they run downstairs, they jump on stage, they open with Sgt. Pepper, and he knew that, you know, the Beatles were going to be in the audience. And apparently, I mean, obviously the song kills. I mean, it rips the whole, people's faces are falling to the floor. And the story that I heard after the fact was George says to Paul, hey man, come on, we got to go back to the studio and redo the bloody guitars. Because it was so amazing. That's a true story.
Just dropped their jaws. They could not
to the floor.
Believe that he did that. Hey, in the treatment of mental illness, there's Crazy, and then there's Dr. Jack Gallagher. It's the new hit drama Mental Tuesday at 9, 8 Central, only on Fox. And speaking of Sgt. Pepper's, as we go to break on Rockline, check this out.
Yeah, it was 20 years ago today. Never told the fantasy. They were going in and out of style, with a guarantee to bring a smile.
rock line.
Jimi Hendrix Experience there. Hey, Joe. And was it Jimmy James that played that at Cafe Wa in New York, and Chas Chandler caught that many, many moons ago? Did I hit one right there?
You got that right.
You got that right.
You got that right.
All right.
Leonard Skinner. It's Tony Scott, and I'm sitting here in Los Angeles with Eddie Kramer, who's got such a body of work with the great Jimi Hendrix, and Billy Cox, of course. We'll hear something from him with Jimmy, and John McDermott in Boston, and this amazing book, Ultimate Hendrix. And trust me, you guys, if you're Hendrix fans, have got to have this in your collection. Let's go to Pensacola, Florida. It's George on Rockline. What's up, George?
No, what's up, guys? Doing tonight?
Hello.
Hello.
Go ahead. We're waiting.
Hi. My question is: the last thing I really ever heard from Jimmy being recorded was the Band of Gypsies at live at the Fillmore East. I think it was 1970. And I was just wondering if Jimmy had anything planned. What his next project was before he had died? Was he going to get the Experience back together? Or did the Gypsies have something going on in the studio? Or what was the deal with that?
Who's going to take that one?
Billy, you take it.
Yeah, well, we toured after the Band of Gypsies broke up. I went with the Experience. Then it was Mitchell, myself, and Jimmy. And we had made a European tour. So that was going on at that particular time.
Billy, would you like to introduce the next tune we're going to play on Rockline?
Yeah. Okay, so we're at the house at Woodstock. Early in the morning, I finished my Cheerios. Our amps are laying out on the patio. Our guitars in. So I go out and I start playing, for some strange reason, Big Ben, trying to wake everybody up. All of a sudden, Jimmy's in his drawer. He says, "Hold it, keep playing it, keep playing." So he runs down. So we go. Then he says, and then all of a sudden. So Dolly Dagger was born right on the patio at the old house in Woodstock.
And it's here on Rockline. I think. There it is. It's Billy Cox ripping it up on Dolly Dagger, some Rainbow Bridge, and what of this Devin mentioned in the tune, Billy?
Yeah, that was Jimmy's main squeeze, and she was a fine sister, I tell you. Devin Wilson.
She was a fox, never mind.
She was a fox, he really was.
Woo! Yeah. Foxy lady. Now, what about, true that he slept with his guitar, gentlemen?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, my opinion, I've always heard that. Never witnessed it, but I always heard that.
All right, I got a mystery clip for you. We got to play a mystery clip because we're running short on time. I want you to identify the voice with Jimmy. Roll it.
Starfleet to scout ship, please give your position. Over.
I am in orbit around the third planet of star known as Sun. Over.
May this be Earth. Over.
Positive. It is known to have some form of intelligent species. Over.
I think we should take a look.
Who is the other guy?
Well,
I think Chas Chandler.
As sure as we're sitting here, you can't mistake that northern voice.
I thought it might be you, Eddie.
No, I don't have that bloody voice. That's reserved for Chas Chandler.
Chas Chandler.
From the north, right.
When was that done?
67. Yeah.
Well, this has been a great day. We're about to sign off. We have three amazing co-authors of a book called Ultimate Hendrix, and Eddie Kramer here in Los Angeles, Billy Cox in Nashville, and John McDermott out there in Boston, in the booth screaming something at me. I don't know exactly what that was. But final thoughts, guys. Anything?
Yeah, Jimmy rules.
By the way, let's go to break. We'll come back and say goodbye. This is Rockline.
Circus mind that's running wild. Angel came down.
About his mother who had passed away. Jimmy there with Angel. as we say goodbye to some interesting folks. KramerArchives.com, Eddie Kramer, correct?
Photographs, yep.
Your photographs. Billy Cox, you've got an album out you want to hit here real quick?
Yeah, The Band of Gypsies Return. It's currently, we're really working on another one now called The Last Gypsy Standing.
Beautiful.
Should be through with it in about a month and a half.
And John McDermott in Boston, thank you. Ultimate Hendrix, written by Eddie Kramer, Billy Cox, and John McDermott. It's a great book, great photos. Bob Merlis, thank you. Janie Hendrix, we thank you. JimiHendrix.com. Do we have information there? I believe we do. This is Tony Scott for Bob Coburn. Thank you so much for hanging out with Rockline. And BC should be back next week. Have a great night, everybody. Thanks for listening.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Rockline has been brought to you by Mental on Fox. Rockline is produced by Greg Jernigan and mixed by Jimmy Rash. Thanks to Chris Martin and David Brown for their invaluable contributions. And to Jamie Sutton and Valley Sound Studios, the home of Rockline. I'm Bob Coburn, and I'll be seeing you.